The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So I've been away the last month or so on retreat. I've had the privilege of sitting a self-retreat. A friend let me use her little house on the coast of Oregon, so I was really surrounded by nature and a lot of water. It's a very fortunate, beautiful setting for self-retreat, where the house I was in, I could just sit there at my breakfast and look out at the water. And one morning I was treated to about a 15-minute display of many whales kind of surfacing, blowing, diving, seeing their tails, sometimes coming up and seeming to circle, doing some feeding. It was just mind-blowing. And they were pretty close in, you know. The water drops off, I think it must drop off there. So these were pretty close in, so I really got a show. And so I think, you know, being in the nature and especially around the water, this informed my meditation, a lot of water imagery coming in. And maybe this is why in my practice, often when I do a self-retreat, there's something, some phrase from the Buddhist teaching or some poem or some snippet that recurs. It keeps revisiting me in my meditation, and it's like it's teaching me each time it arises. It arises as and is relevant to whatever's happening in the moment. And that happened this time, and it was around a water image. The passage that kept recurring was related to a water image, and the image is of a flood. And actually, the Buddha used a lot of water analogies in his teaching. And so it comes up a lot in different ways at different times. But this one of the flood comes up quite a bit. And the flood usually refers to kind of how we are overwhelmed by the forces of our minds, overwhelmed by the forces of the world, overwhelmed by kind of the ways that we get caught. And we could say, maybe in a simple way, that the flood refers to our suffering. And sometimes we do feel like we're drowning in our suffering. I think we could say that the flood is one way we could look at the flood is kind of the combination of conditions of our lives, our past, what's happened to us, kind of the momentum of what's gone on in our lives. And here we are in the midst of it, and sometimes it feels like we're barely able to keep our heads above water. I mean, even these analogies resonate for us. We use this language today, you know, the feeling like I'm drowning, feeling overwhelmed. I'm hardly able to keep my head above water with what's happening for me. And, you know, one of the things the Buddha pointed to was that quality of feeling like we're drowned and overwhelmed, it often feels like it's stuff out there in the world that's doing it to us. It feels like the flood is beyond our control. That's often the way it feels like, and I think that's often why we feel like we're drowning. But in his own exploration of his mind, what one of the key pieces he came to and it was able to articulate for the rest of us is that while the conditions of the world contribute to what's experienced as that flood, the flood doesn't exist without our reactivity to what's happening in the world. And so the flood itself is really the transcending of the flood, or the ability to cross the flood, And that's the analogy that we'll explore here. The ability to cross the flood is possible because we can look at our own minds and see, where is our own mind contributing to this flood? And the Buddha points particularly to greed, aversion, and delusion. Greed, aversion, and confusion. That these are the three forces of our mind that create the conditions for us to be swamped, for us to be feel like we're drowning. And so this is the imagery that kept coming in my mind, this image of the flood, and that the flood is really the flood of our own reactivity to the world. The flood is not what's happening in the world itself. And so I'll read this little, it's very brief, this little piece that kept coming back to me. So a being approached the Buddha, and having approached, he honored the Buddha and said, "How did you cross the flood?" And the Buddha said, "By not halting, friend, and not straining, I crossed the flood." And there's a particular translation of that that was the phrase that kept coming back to me. The phrase was, "By neither tarrying nor hurrying, I crossed the flood." That was a phrase that kept coming up at different times in my meditation. And then the person is not quite understanding what the Buddha says, and he says, "But how is it that by not halting and not straining you cross the flood?" And the Buddha said, "When I came to a standstill, friend, then I sank. But when I struggled, then I got swept away. It is in this way, friend, that by not halting and not straining I cross the flood." So by neither tarrying nor hurrying, I crossed the flood. Some of the notes and comments about this line, by neither tarrying nor hurrying, mention that it's almost meant to be a paradox. Because if you think about what you might do if you've got a stream that's rushing and flooded and you want to cross it, what would you do? You'd search out a place where you could get your footing, right? You'd find a stone you could stand on. You'd get your footing there, and then you'd get the other foot there quickly. And then you'd search out, you'd stand there for a while looking for where's the next place you could find to get your foot. And then you'd put your foot there and get the foot there quickly. So it's precisely by stopping and moving quickly that we get across a literal flood. And so the Buddha, one of the commentaries says, the Buddha actually meant to kind of startle the mind here. It's like, what? Wait a minute, that's not how it usually works. So that you'd think about it, so that you'd kind of reflect, what does this mean? By neither tarrying nor hurrying, I cross the flood. So first of all, in terms of this analogy, this isn't the first time this has been a meaningful analogy to me. It came up in different ways on this retreat, and I don't know that I'll get to all the pieces. I don't even remember all of the pieces. That was what was kind of fun about it. It's like my mind was giving me a Dharma talk, and I was realizing, yeah, I'm not going to remember this. So I don't think I'll remember everything, but there's some pieces that I feel like I can bring from my time and from earlier reflections on this teaching. And one of the things that has inspired me about this in the past is that, first of all, somebody came to the Buddha and said, "How did you cross the flood?" And this imagery was very resonant for the Buddha. He's like, yeah. And it's like, you didn't have to stop and ask, what do you mean? It's like, yeah, I know what you mean, yeah. And this is what I did, by neither tarrying nor hurrying. And so he resonated with the difficulty and with the feeling of the flood. in his own life. And then another piece that I kind of take inspiration from is that it's almost like the Buddha. I'll just try to not move. It's almost like the Buddha, it seems to me, he says, okay, by tarrying, I sank. So he tried tarrying. It didn't work for him. He tried hurrying. That didn't work for him either. So it's like he had to find his way. He made mistakes. He sank. He got swept away. And so it's like, okay, yeah. This flood, this kind of being overwhelmed by experience, this happened to the Buddha too. Okay, so I'm overwhelmed by my experience right now. Yeah, I'm in good company. So that's a way that this is has been resonant for me. Kind of just like, yeah, this is the way it goes in practice. We don't somehow figure it out and then forevermore we don't struggle anymore. There's this kind of trial and error. You know, there's times I find that certain experience arises and it feels like my mind gets stuck to it and tarries with it. Other times a similar kind of experience arises and the mind like just wants to jump over it and hurry past it. So it's not like the same thing happens every time. So we need to just be aware and have a sense of what's happening for us in our meditation. So, you know, I wanted to explore maybe what some of these words mean, you know, in my own experience. How have I felt, you know, what were the qualities of tarrying and hurrying and how did they come about? So just to give you some sense of this for your own practice, these kind of qualities they're part and parcel of our meditation. You know, the tarrying piece is you know where we get stuck to something. Some obvious ways might be we tarry when we just get like really bored and kind of sunk and just have a kind of a sleepiness or dullness. It's just like we give up and we just sink. That quality of that would be a tarrying, being caught by that hindrance of sloth, that kind of sense of dullness and non-engagement. And kind of on the hurrying side, the counterpoint to that would be the restlessness, the restless quality of mind, the hindrance of restlessness, of the mind feeling very jumpy and kind of not able to land anywhere. And so both of those, if we think of those, it's like, okay, so well, there's the kind of sinking into dullness and then the kind of jumping around. What's between those two? Maybe it's just a simple presence, meeting this experience. Not kind of holding on to it, not trying to figure it out. We just, oh, this is what's here. And what's next? And what's next? And so that's one side of the tarrying and hurrying, the kind of the hindrance of sloth and torpor or restlessness and worry. Those are kind of two flavors of tarrying and hurrying that might come up in our meditation. And then the quality of, like for instance, of greed, of wanting something, that could either lead, at least in my experience, can either be a kind of tarrying. It's like, oh, I like this. Let's hang out here for a while. This feels pretty good. And that can happen. That can happen for something that's, you know, that takes us away from mindfulness. You know, we can kind of like, oh yeah, let's just like check out a mindfulness and watch this movie. You know, that would be a form of tarrying, of kind of grasping onto something pleasant and checking out. But it also might be that kind of greed can be subtler. It might be, oh, this is an interesting experience. Oh, let's like, you know, this feels good. Let's hang out here for a while. Because as we do meditate, you know, there are some pleasant experiences that can arise and we can, out of a kind of a greed, get stuck to them. That's a kind of tarrying, too. And yet the greed isn't just about tarrying. So, you know, so this is another interesting piece about this reflection, is that I think in some ways it's an interesting lens on our practice to think about it in terms of tarrying and hurrying, because it's kind of cuts across greed, aversion, and delusion. It's not that all greed is going to be tarrying and all aversion is going to be hurrying. And so there's a quality in the mind that kind of gets stuck to something, kind of, ooh, let's kind of contract around it and hold to it, versus a quality in the mind that's like, oh yeah, let's just kind of move on. And that quality of mind can be felt. We can kind of get accustomed to that quality. And this was something that began kind of being clear to me on the retreat, that kind of this, through this kind of exploration of tarrying and hurrying, it wasn't so much that the mind was tuning into greed and aversion, it was tuning into, is the mind kind of contracting and holding, or is the mind kind of popping around? So, and that was useful to kind of check into that. There's another teaching in one of the key teachings the Buddha gave on mindfulness, the Satipatthana Sutta, the four foundations of mindfulness. In the third foundation of mindfulness, where the instructions are kind of inclining us to look at our minds, to look at what's going on in our minds. I mean, often we start by noticing our physical experience, noticing the body, but through these foundations, the teachings progress to help us understand, look at our minds. And in one of the places he encourages us to notice is, notice when the mind is contracted and notice when the mind is distracted. Just very simply. So mindfulness of that. And in that sutta, it says something along, this paraphrase, but something along the lines of, when there's a contracted mind, one knows there's a contracted mind. When there's a distracted mind, one knows there's a distracted mind. It doesn't say, when there's a contracted mind, fix it and get rid of it. Or when there's a distracted mind, settle it down so that it's like calm again. It says, when there's a contracted mind, know it's contracted. When there's a distracted mind, know it's distracted. And so similarly, I think it's kind of like, when there's tarrying, we know we're tarrying. We need to know that. When there's hurrying, we need to know that. And so tuning into that quality of tarrying and hurrying, contracted, distracted, has been a really useful exploration in my own practice. And it kind of like, initially it feels like the real obvious stuff in life. You know, like, oh yeah, I'm rushing to get to this place, or I'm really stuck on this problem. You know, so initially it might feel like the bigger kinds of tarrying and hurrying. But it can get very, very subtle. Very just minuscule, almost just like a moment. This afternoon I was doing a meditation, and as I was doing it, there was something that happened, I can't even remember what arose, but there was almost like this attitude of, oh yeah, that's there, check, you know, kind of, yep, move on. And in having done this kind of tarrying and hurrying, it's like, oh, that feeling is hurrying. It's not really opening to that experience. It's like, okay, yep, got that, what's next? And so that quality of hurrying was present in a very, like, quiet, subtle way. And this exploration helped me to notice that. And so, you know, coming back to what I was saying around this quality, it cuts across greed and aversion. You know, we might have greed and it be a tarrying quality. Something pleasant is happening and we want to hang out with it. But we might also have greed and have it be a hurrying thing. It might be, oh yeah, let me get to that thing. Let me get that next great experience. You know, we live our lives a lot by kind of like jumping into the future, looking for that next hit. And so that feeling of leaning forward, or that feeling of hanging out, I think that this teaching is encouraging us to recognize that. as the Buddha says, when he began exploring it from this perspective, he understood that when he tarried, he sank. And when he hurried, he got swept away. So that the exploration isn't about just fixing the tarrying and hurrying, but beginning to understand it, beginning to recognize it. And likewise for aversion. You know, we can, you know, sometimes we might think that with aversion, the immediate movement would be hurrying away from it. You know, that, you know, yeah, let me get rid of this unpleasant thing. Let me go away from this unpleasant thing. But my experience with aversion, and I would say that I've done a lot of work with aversion. This mind has oriented towards aversion as its go-to strategy for fixing my life. Like, okay, here's this unpleasant thing. If I can get rid of it, then I'll be okay. And my way of getting rid of it was, okay, I'm going to hang out with it, hold on to it, so that I can figure out how to get rid of it. So for me, the feeling of aversion is a lot about tarrying, paradoxically. If for some, you know, it's like, what? Why? And as I recognize it, it's not like, why do I hang on to the unpleasant? This is why. It's like I get stuck to the unpleasant, trying to push it away. That's tarrying with that aversion. That aversion is creating that tarrying mind. But it also can create a hurrying mind. You know, one friend of mine, who tends to be more the greedy type, who tends to have more of the strategy of, oh yeah, let me go to the pleasant in order to fix things in his life. He said, well, I've actually discovered that greed and aversion are just the same, because when I have aversion to something, then I just let it go and want to go to something pleasant. I said, that's greed. You know, aversion, in aversion, you might have the aversion initially. You know, that's saying, oh, I don't like this thing. But the thing that's wanting to take you to something pleasant, that's greed. So for me, the kind of basic sense of aversion is stuck to something, trying to get rid of it. So that's that, again, that quality of tarrying. So those are a few kind of more obvious ways that the tarrying and hurrying can be explored. And the Buddha offered another way to consider this in another teaching, another sutta. I'll just read the beginning of this. This is a poem called A Single Excellent Night. And the beginning of it reads, "Let not a person revive the past or on the future build their hopes. For the past has been left behind, and the future has not been reached. Instead, with insight, let them see each presently arisen state. Let them know that and be sure of it, invincibly, unshakably." And so another way to think about this tarrying and hurrying might be, when we're caught in the past, thinking about the past. That's a kind of tarrying. And it's like, what was happening in the past? You know, how can I have done this? Or sometimes I have gotten caught in the past trying to figure out how to have a better past. You know, not going to happen. So that quality of like reviving the past, that might be considered a kind of a way of tarrying. And then the building hopes on the future. It's like, you know, jumping into the next moment, not actually being here. That could be a way of hurrying. So, you know, you're either kind of lagging behind the present moment or jumping ahead of the present moment. And the Buddha encourages, instead, be in the present moment with understanding. Be here. Know what's happening now. And to me, this is kind of the point. But this is what it means to neither tarry nor hurry. What's here? What's this experience? Touch it. Meet it. And then what's the next experience? Touch that, meet that. Not like, oh, this experience, kind of try to hold on to it or grip onto it. Not try to like leapfrog off of it because it's unpleasant. Get to the next thing. Just like, yep, that. And then that. And this is a way in which this line, neither tarrying nor hurrying, has actually served me in my meditation as a reminder to, let's like give every experience its due, but without clinging to it, without like, you know, gripping to it, and without also like jumping off of it, kind of like I was describing earlier. It was like, yep, check, notice that already. It's like, yeah, I didn't really notice that. It was more like, okay, look somewhere else. So this kind of sense of meeting the present moment, meeting this experience, meeting things we like with a balance of mind that understands holding on to it, holding on to something we might like, sinks us. And again, this is what the Buddha, I think, noticed in his own experience. When I held on to something pleasant, I just sank. And this can also be true of even wholesome states of mind. You know, this again is how the teaching gets more subtle. I think this teaching actually can take us all the way. You know, this kind of reflection. Because there, at different times of our practice, there are different things that we will tarry and hurry with. Initially, it's probably our everyday kind of things, our views and our ideas about what should and shouldn't happen, kind of likes and dislikes in the world, people we want to have close to us or frustrating relationships. These are the places where we tend to have this experience of holding on and kind of leaping away from. But as we practice, as our mind settles down, some of those can fall away. You know, some of those kind of more obvious reactivities can fall away, and we start to it's kind of like we've got these different layers of the ways we attach to things, different layers in our minds of things we cling to and hold on to. And, you know, as we do this work, as we explore meditation and actually land in an appreciation of being in the present moment, we can get attached to that. We can get attached to how good it feels when we get concentrated. We can get attached to how good it feels when we can clearly know what's arising, just the next moment of experience. And you know, this is not something we have to, you know, beat ourselves up about. Again, it's a very natural kind of thing. And in some ways, the movement in our practice is a kind of a staged letting go. It's like, at least in my experience, you know, it's like as my mind began to settle down in meditation, it's like, yeah, I kind of clung to that. It's like, oh, this feels good. It's given me a break from all of this stuff, all of this really hard stuff. And that's not a bad thing, you know, that our mind can kind of land here with something more restful that helps it to let go of the kind of more broad kinds of struggles that we have. And so this flood, in a way, you know, it's like it's got layers to it. It's got the, you know, the kind of the big layers of relationship and life choices, and then you know, it's got some more subtle layers and some more subtle layers. And so as we practice, it's like some of those layers begin to diminish. And then we get to look at the struggles and the ways we tarry and hurry with the more subtle layers of our struggles. And yet, what seems to be the case is that one of the things that supports us kind of letting go of the grosser level of the struggle is to land a little bit in this, maybe in a place of, oh, I can actually give my mind a rest by finding some concentration, by being present with my experience. And so this has been kind of a very, big way that my practice has unfolded, that, there were ways in which I could see that I was clinging to the meditation, identified as being a meditator and doing this practice. And yet, that was helping me to let go of this massive aversion and massive anger and self-hatred. And then as that anger and self-hatred fell away, then this kind of holding to that, I'm a meditator, that began to be the place where I could feel the tarrying and hurrying. Oh, I'm holding on to being this meditator. Or, better get all of these jhana states, better do all this kind of practice, that kind of, I'm going to go to Burma, do this, do that. That began to be experienced as suffering. But it wasn't experienced as suffering when the mind was so kind of taken over by this big aversion. But as the aversion, the self-hatred, the anger began to diminish, then there's more of a kind of an understanding of the ways in which the holding now to this identity as a meditator, to doing the practice, to getting all of these things, to checking off the boxes of this monastery and that monastery, how much suffering that is. And that now could be seen. It's like, okay, now this is what I get to look at. Now this is the tarrying and the hurrying that's relevant for this exploration. It's not a problem. It's not a mistake. Sometimes I offer a phrase. It's like, let the suffering be your guide. Because I knew that I was clinging to, and as a teacher, I hear people say, I find myself clinging to the meditation. Does that mean I shouldn't meditate? Well, no. No, it doesn't mean that you shouldn't meditate. It's useful to be aware that you're clinging to the meditation. And yet, I knew I was clinging to the meditation, but I wasn't experiencing suffering around that early on in my practice because there was so much support for what I was learning in terms of the mind beginning to be able to navigate all the craziness that it had been living with. And so the moment to begin, for me to begin to recognize and explore that clinging to the meditation was when it began to be experienced as suffering. When I was sitting down and it's like, where is that state of calm? The mind kind of clinging to finding something and so much suffering around that. Like that's what I got to look at in that moment. It doesn't mean to stop meditating, but it means to notice, where am I tarrying? Ah, tarrying with wanting this state of calm or rushing to find something. So one thing about this flood image, I think, sometimes we might think of it and, the feeling, at least for me, all this self-hatred, this kind of anger and a lot of really challenging states in the mind, felt like this flood of the past, it's like my life, my conditions, my history. It's like it did feel like it was something, palpable. And that's, I think, often the way the flood feels. Like it is kind of this accumulation of conditions and history and choices and, you know, ways that we've engaged. I spend so much time being angry and hating myself. And, you know, it's like another phrase the Buddha offers often is whatever we frequently ponder becomes the inclination of our mind. And so this mind, frequently engaged in self-hatred and anger and aversion, and that was a lot of what kind of came. That was the flood. You know, so much of what I experienced was that part of the flood. And it feels like, in some ways, that all of that conditioning, it is this flood. You know, it's like, it's an existent thing. It kind of feels like that. But one of the pointings in this teaching, in the teaching as a whole, is that conditioning, yes, the conditioning is there, the causes and conditions of the past are there, but whether we are struggling in this moment is not necessarily determined by the past. There is a possibility in this moment to relate to all of that flood of conditioning in a different way. And in that, relating to it in a different way, the experience of the flood shifts dramatically. The experience, at times it can be, it's not always like this, but at times it can be just as the mind kind of recognizes, oh yeah, you know, this is self-hatred. Well, certainly I spent a lot of time noticing self-hatred and feeling like I was barely able to keep my head above the water. And so, you know, that kind of the practice has these stages to it. Okay, this is self-hatred, and wow, this is really hard. I feel like I'm barely able to kind of, you know, navigate this river. I felt like I'm not, like, crossing the river. I feel like I'm trying not to be, pulled under and drowned in the river. I'm barely, like, you know, keeping my head above water. So there are definitely times in the practice that the experience of the flood is that we're kind of in the flood and maybe able to breathe, but, you know, still really feeling that quality of the flood. But there are times when the mind can really neither tarry nor hurry with, oh, this is what it's, this is the arising of self-hatred. That's what's happening right now. And it's like the flood vanishes. There is no flood without tarrying and hurrying. The tarrying and the hurrying make the flood. And so this image, this was really the image that came to me, you know, as I was practicing on this retreat. It's just the sense of the neither tarrying nor hurrying, and just like, you know, it's like walking, like walking on water, or just having the water vanish. Just they're not being that swept away or sinking quality. When the mind can really just, oh, this is what's happening. Now that's, as I said, that is a training. It's not something that we can just flip. Oh, okay, I'll just be here with this. There's so much momentum of the flood. There's so much momentum of, you know, of the habits of reaction, of those strategies I mentioned, you know, the aversive quality is my was my go-to strategy. It's like the first thing that I had to learn is that, yeah, this is self-hatred and I don't like it. Okay, can I be with that? I don't like self-hatred. Can I be with that? So that there's the kind of the learning that we have around, you know, just meeting how our minds are relating to the experience. So those are my reflections on this topic. Are there comments or thoughts? Or I wonder if I should switch to the other mic. It's kind of gotten. I think I'll switch.
I was hurrying. I just wanted to mention that neither tearing nor hurrying is also how you play music.
Beautiful. Yeah, that, and I would imagine how you also engage in any kind of, I'm thinking basketball right now because we're in the playoffs, but, you know, that kind of quality of really being in the experience of, I mean, you may have to move quickly, you may have to do a passage with quick movement, but you can't rush it, right? Yeah, and that's a beautiful analogy, yeah. Other reflections, thoughts, questions. It doesn't have to be about the talk if there's anything in your practice or...
I noticed that for me, I read a different translation, and it was something more like, when I pressed forward, I was whirled about, and when I tarried, I sank. And often, I've noticed in my practice that if I think I know what I ought to be doing, that's the then I get whirled about.
Yes, that's the pressing forward, exactly.
And whirling about is not... a voyage of discovery. It's just seeing, it's just, you know.
Right.
It's so, kind of dizziness.
You know, what you're pointing to, too, is like recognizing that kind of feeling of thinking I should know. And that's what I've been pointing to. You know, it's like there's so many different ways in which that happens. For me, a lot of it was around like investigation. It's like, ooh, this is interesting. You know, that was a little bit of tarrying. You know, it was a useful quality of mind, that investigation, but the kind of the, ooh, let's find out what's going on. You know, that's the quality of the kind of contraction. So yeah, I mean, we get familiar with that.
And the staying still was just sort of the kind of dull states of mind that happen when one notices. I mean, when I noticed that I was in a rut, but I was content
to be in the rut.
Yeah, because you know it's a strategy for passing the time.
Yep.
Getting through the painful long sit before dinner or something.
You know. Yeah, that quality. Yep. Yeah.
And that does sink one. It, you know, just it deadens the mind rather than being bright and attentive. It's just dull, dull, dull.
Thanks. Yeah. Anyone else? Yeah.
I guess I've heard people like athletes and maybe musicians, other things, being in the flow. would be sort of maybe not hurrying or just like being there entirely.
Yes.
In, you know, participating in the present.
Exactly. Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's that. That's that quality of except it is. I mean, I want to take care or be careful. I mean, there's a similarity there.
Oh, maybe not.
You know, there's a similarity there towards the, to the quality in the mind of an athlete in the moment, in the flow, the quality of a musician who's right with their music. There's a similarity there, but the. That is a form of mindfulness and awareness, mm-hmm. But it's not necessarily the form of mindfulness and awareness that allows us to transform our hearts and transcend this flood. It's not bad. It's just. I just want to clarify that it's not necessarily, that's not necessarily what we're going for. It's almost, that's more almost a concentration state in a way.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
That's true. Because they may not be aware that they're in the flow.
Well, even that, I mean, yeah. The key with right mindfulness, the kind of mindfulness that frees our heart, that begins to transform this flood, is that it is interested in exploring the qualities in the mind. Mm-hmm. It's interested in exploring, oh, this is greed arising. This is aversion arising. This is anger arising. It's interested in the, oh, this is love arising. This is joy arising. In the, like, for instance, in somebody being in the flow of playing music or playing basketball, the goal there is to play music or play basketball,
right.
Not to observe the mind in how it's doing that.
Right.
So that's kind of the difference.
Yeah. No, yeah. That's good. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, right next to you.
I actually have a well-formulated question, but I didn't ask
that's
it.
That's fine, yeah.
That's I don't fine. Know if it is of any interest to people, so I was actually thinking to ask you after, but since nobody's asking, I'll take a stab. So it attracted my attention a lot that you were talking about aversion for you is the main way of relating to difficult experience, because it is the main way of relating to difficult experience for me. And I also could relate to what you described when aversion arises, that I'm very much staring, very much staying with it, and very much trying to sort things out in an effort to get rid of it. So I've tried many ways of getting rid of a particular problem, and again, just give like two sentence snippet. Because of a particular medical condition that I have, I need to stick to a certain diet, which is very restrictive, and I'm having a lot of difficulty doing that. And when I'm not doing it, I'm damaging my body, so I feel a sense of urgency. So I understand the sense of urgency is not very helpful, because all that I'm accomplishing is worse adherence to the diet. So anyway, the only thing that has been marginally promising in approaching that, after about a year of trying different external strategies, I say, okay, well, I got inspired by right effort of Noble Eightfold Path component that what I understood from it, that we need to kind of actively manage our mental states, promote positive states, counter negative, and so on and so forth. So, and my experience with that has been that while that approach has been more helpful, it seems like a full-time job. I literally cannot do anything else. If I'm doing anything else of significance, like if I'm grocery shopping, that's fine. But if I'm attending to my child, there is no way, no how.
Yes.
So I just don't know how to do that skillfully.
Yeah. Well, I mean, part of it, you're noticing, I think, you know, right effort. I mean, effort is effort. Effort means we have to apply our attention in a direction. And that is, you know, we do that when we can do that. And then over time, it's like that does begin to wear new grooves in the mind, such that when we are not able to actively apply effort, maybe our mind tends towards these new grooves instead of the old grooves. So it does help to do this kind of active kind of, okay, yep, I'm going to consciously step aside from that, or I'm going to choose this, I'm going to choose to orient in this way. But there are going to be times where like, as you say, you know, you have something else you need to attend to. You're not going to be able to hold that in your mind. What I can say is that if you're finding it useful to do it when you're doing it, do it. I mean, like, you know, do it when you can do it. And then when you can't do it, give yourself a break, you know, give yourself a break around it. It does, I think, over time tend to, I mean, one of the things here about practice is it's not like a turn on the dime thing, you know, it's more like turning a battleship. It's a long process. So be patient. Have some patience with the process. And but just keep going, because the kind of the new grooves that you're wearing will have some traction. That it will begin to spread into other parts of your life. So don't expect yourself to be able to hold to it the whole time. That may create some ease, you know, that if you think you should be able to hold to right effort all the time, you know, this kind of active doing practice, you know, I find that just actually doesn't work very well in daily life, to have this idea of, I'm going to be continuously mindful all day long and going to be noticing when I'm, you know, engaged in that and switch to that. It's like, we don't have time for that. That kind of picking up of a doing. But there is one thing I can suggest too, a tool that I encourage in daily life practice is, you know, when you notice that you do have time, that mindfulness comes back right there in that moment. It's like, okay, can I have some kindness and compassion for myself right now? Can I be at ease with here and now? Can I not beat myself up for not having been mindful for those moments before, but really take in this moment? Okay, I'm aware now. I'm you know, maybe I can remind myself of some wholesome things right now. And then kind of let it go. Don't try to hold on to that. What I find is that if we engage with it in this light touch in daily life, if we're trying to pick up the backpack of right effort and carry it around with us all day, we're going to get exhausted and probably stop. And so this is a different way. It's like, you know, it's almost like we just pick up the effort when the effort arises. There it is. Mindfulness arises. And so, okay, there's that quality, and can I know this experience? And then, you know, don't try to hold on to it. Just get on with your day, and then notice the next time it arises. That creates a kind of that is essentially the right effort that's happening there, is that you're noticing the wholesome quality of mindfulness when it arises. You're inclining yourself towards that as it arises. And that creates the conditions for more of those moments, partly because you're recognizing it, you know, partly because you're noticing it, and partly because, you know, so that noticing essentially creates the conditions for more noticing. And actually, this moment of kind of mindfulness returning happens a lot. We don't notice it as much as it happens in some ways. It's almost like it gets kind of buried in the flood. As soon as it comes up, it's swamped in the flood. And so we kind of, if we're attuning ourselves to noticing that moment, then essentially our mind notices more of it. And that begins to create a kind of a light layer of mindfulness that's much less effortful, that gives us a kind of much more flexibility with how we navigate our day. So I would really encourage you to be a little lighter with yourself around it. When you have the kind of the bandwidth, if you're, like you said, maybe doing the dishes or grocery shopping, you can keep it in your mind. But at other times, you can just let yourself let it go and be okay with that. Know that it's just not possible to hold that in our minds. I mean, partly that's why we go on retreat, so that we can let go of everything else in our lives, you know, and just have the right effort, right mindfulness, be what we're aiming for. But in our everyday lives, we can't do that. So I would encourage you to keep going there, but also to be a little lighter about it. And then, one other piece I'll say is that different ways to cultivate these qualities. One way is to notice when notice when it's arising, and kind of the right effort is to shift. You know, we might think that when something difficult is arising or something unwholesome is arising, right effort is to shift away from it or to replace it with something else actively. But also right effort, you know, just being mindful of what's here. Oh, this frustration is arising. This kind of heaviness around my health, that kind of agitation around my health, that's arising. To be just mindful of that and kind of allowing. It's like, okay, well, that's what's happening. There's frustration arising. That mindfulness of that actually is right effort. Because what that does, you know, mindful awareness, oh, I'm aware of that frustration. That creates the conditions for it not to be engaged with as frustration. You know, it's like instead of being frustrated and kind of digging the rut of frustration, it's like we're kind of hovering with it. It's not deepening the rut. And it's creating some understanding about the frustration. And so it creates that when we're mindful of something challenging like that, it creates the conditions for it to happen less often in the future. And so just kind of the gentle kind of like, oh, this is what's happening right now. Can I allow myself to know that? That already is right effort. And so I want to just put that out there too. Sometimes we can have an idea about what right effort means is when this kind of difficult things arises, I'm supposed to, oh, let me give myself some loving kindness or, you know, do something very active. And sometimes the easier thing to do, if we can kind of land with it, is like, oh yeah, frustration's happening. Of course frustration's happening. This is a painful situation. Yes, okay. Can I know that frustration? Neither tarry nor hurry with frustration. You know, kind of that sense of, oh, that's what's here. So it's time to stop. So thank you.